Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Josh Richmond, political reporter for the Bay Area News Group, and your moderator tonight. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest tonight, Congressman Marc Desaulniers. Marc Desaulniers was sworn in this past January as a member of the 114th Congress, representing California's 11th District and a majority of Contra Costa County. Since taking office, he has already voted on a number of significant bills, including fast-track authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership and approving the Keystone XL pipeline, although I don't think you approved it.
I voted against both of those.
Yes, but you voted. He has sponsored and co-sponsored dozens of pieces of legislation focused on student debt reform, protecting the rights of women and veterans, and improving services for youth and the impoverished. Before moving to Capitol Hill, Congressman Desaulniers served the public in a variety of roles, including as a Concord City Council member and mayor, Contra Costa County Supervisor, California State Assemblyman, and California State Senator. Tonight, we are here to discuss Congressman Desaulniers' new digs in Washington, D.C., and what he hopes to accomplish during his first term in the House. Please join me in welcoming Congressman Desaulniers to the Commonwealth Club. So, last year, when we spoke with your predecessor, George Miller, on this very stage, in this very room, he took umbrage at the idea that you should have to fill anybody's shoes. He was very adamant that you should be your own man and sort of cut your own path there. How's that going? Do you feel you're being accepted as your own man on Capitol Hill after succeeding a guy who held the office for 40 years?
Well, I was here for that event. Yeah. Congressman Miller didn't know it. It turns out I was in the back. So I have told people I've heard that comment from everybody, including when the freshman class was at the White House and I'm in the receiving line, and President Obama said, "And who did you replace?" And I said, "George Miller." And he said, "Oh, you've got big shoes to fill." And I'm like, "Come on, Barry." and it's physically impossible for me to replace or to fill George's shoes, but it's also as a metaphor. He was an amazing member of Congress. He was there for 40 years, completely engaged in every subject, a progressive lion, as somebody described him. But I was Senator, I'm spacing on his name now, but a Republican member of the U.S. Senate told me at an early dinner that I was across the table. He said, "You know, George Miller and I served in Congress for a long time, and I didn't agree with him on much, but I always respected him. You could trust his word." So, you know, we were lucky to have him.
Have you spoken at all with Congressman Miller since he left office and you got sworn in?
I have, on occasion. Usually it's fairly comical, just our observations about life. And one of the things I always say to him and his wife, Cynthia, is it's disconcerting for me to see them because they look really healthy and happy. So he does. He's like a big brother to me. He's always been a wonderful friend.
Is this like a Dorian Gray thing where he's suddenly going to start looking younger and you're going to start sort of getting...
I don't think it starts.
Well, what have you found surprising about, you know, these first months in Congress? The thing that you found most surprising as a positive and then the thing that you found most surprising as a negative of being there in the House?
I think most surprising as a positive are two things, really. I mean, as a history major and somebody who still likes to read history a lot, to walk from my office to the House of Representatives floor on the days that you could tolerate being outside in D.C., where it's not humid or freezing, you know, I walk and I can see the back of the Capitol where, until Ronald Reagan switched to the west portico for inaugurations, I physically walk and see where every inauguration speech, so I think, you know, Lincoln stood right there and said, "With malice toward none." Jack Kennedy stood there and said, "Think not, ask not what your country can do for you." So, the reinforcement of what this country's about and what self-government's about, and the very spiritual, historical road that this country still is held around the world when we're at our best, has been reaffirmed for me almost every day there. For whatever reason, we're in a period in our public discourse where it's not as rich and robust or nearly as deep as I think it should be. So I'm a little bit shocked at some of the theatrical aspect of the institution, where you really don't get to talk policy at a level that I think is more satisfying, both for the product but also for the experience.
And why do you think that's changed? What is the cause of that shift towards a shallower discourse?
I think part of it is the country's just very different right now. I mean, Congressman Miller and others told me, you know, one of the things you're going to have to get used to is when you listen to people from other parts of the country, they're not like people from the Bay Area. And they feel that way, too. You know, I make suggestions at committees. I say, all right, I stipulate you think we're crazy. I'm from the Bay Area. However, our economy is doing really well, and our quality of life, in spite of some challenges around housing and transportation, amongst other things. But I'm struck at just the country's very different right now. And if you look at the urban areas in both coasts, and then you look at Central America and the lack of what's happened to their economy in the South, we're both ideologically polarized, but I think some of that's because there are other sociological issues and economic issues at play.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about how technology sort of fits into that. You're in the process of founding an Innovation and the Human Condition Caucus. You've been out visiting companies here in the Bay Area like Google. Yesterday you were at Twitter. What is this about? And who wouldn't want to be part of the Innovation and the Human Condition Caucus?
Well, one of the things about California is, as a native of Massachusetts who spent most of my life here, H.W. Brands has a great book called The Age of Gold that talks about, if anybody wants to read a one-volume history of California, there's a new book called Rush, and then Innovators by Walter Isaacson. You know, there's a reason why all these things are happening, particularly in the Bay Area. People have been coming here since the gold rush to try crazy things and to be innovative. And on the other parts of the country, they're depending on where you are, they're more risk-averse or status quo. It's just part of their tradition. So I wanted to understand, actually I started this when I was in the legislature, how does policy interact with this innovation? We've got issues on privacy, copyright laws, things like that. So how do we continue to nurture this specifically in the Bay Area and in California and the U.S., but also understand that when there are public policy concerns and there may be negative consequences for technology, how do we understand them and try to respond to that in as collaborative a fashion as we can, rather than tech companies running out and hiring contract lobbyists to just fight everything? Why don't we work together? So that was sort of the impetus of it. And then I've been going out slowly. It's an amazing process to see what's happening, in neuroscience alone within 75 miles of where we're sitting, whether it's at the laboratories or Berkeley or Stanford or private. It's astounding what we're going through in terms of innovation.
And how do you think that sort of pertains back to the discourse? I mean, when we talk about the theatrics that go on in the House that you found somewhat disappointing. I mean, are we dealing with a generation of voters, or worse yet, of non-voters who are raised on 140 characters of Twitter and
yeah,
7 seconds of Vine and stuff like that, and so the sound bites now carries more weight than it used to, or does it make people more connected?
I'm not sure. I think there's a, you know, people will constantly refer to this area, age of innovation, to the Industrial Revolution or the evolution of print in terms of the human species. I think that's accurate, and then there's some really good things for that. I mean, all of the information. I was at John Muir this morning with cardiologists. They're explaining what they're doing now at our local hospitals, which are quite transformative in the application of innovation. So there's that side, and then there's the I thought you were going to ask me about Donald Trump this long into the interview.
Will.
I'm sure you will. You're leading up to it. But, you know,
we're saving that for later.
Yeah. So when they're starting to doze off, we'll talk about Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we were just talking a little bit about this, about, you know, the importance of the print media and what I grew up on and having a little deeper. But they can be ideologically different. I mean, when I was a kid, my dad bought the Boston Herald and the Boston Globe, and he said, the Herald's a Republican paper, the Globe's the Democratic paper. If you read everything in both of them, there's probably the truth in there. Well, now we barely have it anymore. And so I'm concerned that, you know, when it comes to problem solving and people understanding policy, we're more, you know, like, that nowadays that opinion equals wisdom is something I heard recently, and I think that's true. I have these discussions where people just bring things up, and I will say, well, where'd you get that from? And they'll say, well, I don't know, I just heard it somewhere. Well, I can't, that doesn't right. really help. You know, you have to attribute it, just like in your business.
Yes, ostensibly, yes.
Ostensibly, yes. Right. But in the social media, you don't need to do that.
No, you don't. Well, you know, let's talk about the difference between opinions and facts with relation to a specific issue here. And fully half the questions in this first batch are all on the same topic. A lot of you can probably guess what that's going to be. You're one of only two Bay Area House members, along with Jared Huffman, I believe, who have not yet said definitively how you're going to vote on the P5+1 nuclear agreement with Iran. Although you've said, you made it clear from the get-go that you're leaning heavily towards supporting it. You wanted to hear from your constituents at the town hall meetings that you're holding this month. What are your thoughts, and what kind of pressure has been brought to bear on you as people talk to you about this? How well informed do you find they are?
Well, it's interesting. Huffman is the other one because he's my roommate in D.C. and is a good friend. We became friends when we were both in the state assembly, and he's not just a friend. I have a great deal of respect for him. I have said over and over again that if I were to vote today, if I had to vote today, I'd vote in favor of it. But that, and I told the administration this, and I've told the leadership in the Democratic caucus, Ms. Pelosi, that I wanted to, I'm a freshman member. This is my first big foreign policy decision. I'd like to be in the district and find out as much about it from both opponents and supporters as possible. My time frame is I've got three more town halls tomorrow in El Cerrito and then two next week in Orinda and Clayton. And during that time, I'm meeting with supporters and opponents, and I'll make a final decision when I'm done with that, just as we go back.
About those town hall meetings, you've had a bunch of them earlier this year, five over this summer recess. You're also doing mobile district office hours where you meet one-on-one with constituents. Some other Bay Area members are similarly ambitious in making themselves available to constituents, and some, quite frankly, are not. Why do you feel it's necessary?
I get a lot of energy, and I love my job because of it. I think, you know, we're all a product of our life experience to a large degree. I was in the retail business before I was in politics. I owned restaurants. Well, if you didn't talk to your customers, first of all, it wasn't fun, and if you didn't talk to them, you were out of business quickly. So one of my favorite parts of this job is the retail business. I must admit, I think I went through a threshold because I got a comment on our Facebook page that said, you're having too many town halls, you should go back to Washington. So either that's a sign of the apocalypse or I've gone too far.
Well, you can't make everybody happy all the time.
I'm aware. But I'm aware.
You know, clearly the complaint that I hear most often about your colleagues is that they have not enough town halls, or when they do them either on a specific topic and will not discuss anything else but that topic, or they do them as telephone town halls, which are very carefully sort of regulated as to who asks questions and how and stuff like that. You like that face-to-face contact.
I do, and I think it's one of our big problems in our public our whole public process right now is running for office is a very vulnerable experience. I mean, it's just different. You can't explain it if you haven't gone through it, I don't think. So unfortunately, at every level, you see these it's partially human nature. You build up a wall to protect yourself. And then there's another part, which is the industrial political side, where your consultants and your pollsters are telling you how to behave. And the public's not stupid. Our species is, we're used to, communication is 80% nonverbal, so we pick up when people aren't being authentic and are genuine, but part of that is being vulnerable, and it can be unpleasant.
All right. From the audience, one of your constituents here, I assume, read that you recently took a trip to Israel, mm-hmm. where I'm sure the Iran agreement was a topic of discussion. Let's start with that, and then I'll ask the audience members' question. What were you hearing there about this?
So for 20 years, the Israeli-American Education Fund has put in, has sponsored and paid for freshmen to go to Israel to clearly see their perspective on things.
Right.
As part of their tax filing, they're precluded from actually lobbying on political. So I thought they were pretty good about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a couple times where I brought it up, and they had, you know, people who were supervising the visit for the foundation said, we can't talk about it. And I said, I'm sorry. I thought it was great. I mean, I learned more about the Middle East, and I've now subsequently been invited by a similar foundation for the Palestinian, who are sympathetic with the Palestinian plight. And I said, as soon as I can go, I'd love to go. But it was good in the sense of you can't, unless you've been there, I don't think I couldn't comprehend of the closeness of everything, and then 3,000 years of very difficult relationships between ethnic groups and religious groups. You just, it's not like anything I have experienced anywhere else in the United States or Europe. So you get the real sense of danger and the difficulty in it from, and we did meet with the former prime minister of the Palestinian Authority and with some Palestinians, but not, it was definitely more Israel.
Well, the audience member's question is that given that the Israelis are some of the most knowledgeable people in the world about dealing with scarce water supply and drought, did you discuss the California drought with anybody? And if so, did they give you any advice?
No, we talked about a little bit about, if my number is, if I remember correctly, 40% of the water in Israel comes from the desalinization plants. So clearly that's something that the challenges in California is we're concerned about some of the environmental impacts. And then the business model heretofore, even in our drought, hasn't worked. So San Diego and Santa Barbara both have big desalinization plants. San Diego's actually had theirs mothballed for a period of time because the business model didn't work for them. So I thought it was interesting. It clearly works in Israel, but because we have more water here normally, it has its challenges.
Do you see our current situation as here in California as being related in some way to climate change? And do you feel that the state and the nation have been effective in addressing climate change?
I think California has. I spent 10 years representing the Bay Area on the California Air Resources Board. And our scientists, this was, God, had to be 20 years ago, were telling us, and these are a scientific panel that from around the country and the world, were telling us about their concerns and their research when it came to human activity and the results of the Industrial Revolution and carbon and its effect on our climate. So I think that clearly these things are a result of that, and the research would tell you that in a pretty demonstrative way that what's happening is a result of human activity. Are we doing enough? California has been, I think, because AB 32, which was done by one of my colleagues, Fran Pavley, you go anywhere in the world and people talk about that legislation, which we are currently putting in place. I mean, you look at the fleet of cars in California, and we led the world on another bill that Fran did that I helped implement on the Air Resources Board, is AB 1493, that required greater efficiency. And then the Obama administration, one of the first things he did when he went in was reinstitute CAFE standards. So all of that has changed our fleet average remarkably and continues to, which is one of the biggest significant drivers of climate change.
It's also significantly depleting our gas tax revenues,
yes,
which is causing transportation infrastructure problems across the country, very notably here in California, where we've just had a legislative special session to start talking about these issues. Transportation was your strong suit in Sacramento. And any thoughts on where we go from here to pay for the roads and the bridges and the other transportation infrastructure that we need?
Well, I did a bill that just started a pilot project that they're now implementing that Governor Brown signed that would study the ability to do vehicle miles traveled. Oregon has done it longer than we have. There's issues around privacy and fairness. Eventually, I think we should do something like that. That bill, even though it was just a pilot, I always laugh as it got me. They have this whole risk assessment, our security people, both the state level and the federal level. So I was told I had two legitimate death threats, but worse than that, I had been invited on Fox TV like three times just on that bill.
And a career death threat.
No, it would just be too painful to go on. So this is another example of transformative times and how policy is trying to deal with it in a thoughtful way because the public, I think, understands you've got to pay for the infrastructure, but the gas tax doesn't work. This is another example, I think, of where my former party, the Republican Party, has themselves boxed in because they know we have to come up with something, mm-hmm. both at the state level and the federal level. But when we get right on the precipice of raising the gas tax or indexing it for inflation, because it wasn't, you're paying less, really, for gas than you used to, we got to the floor and they just couldn't vote for it because they can't go back to their constituents and say, mm-hmm. I voted for a tax increase, even though I think a lot of them understand for the greater good of the country, we've got to come up with something because our infrastructure is falling apart. And economists tell you that next to education, infrastructure is the next big thing when it comes to economic development that the government can do.
Mm-hmm. You just made mention of the fact that you had started out in politics as a Republican. You converted, as it were, to
as a fallen away Catholic, I suppose that's appropriate.
I'm curious. I mean, do you take any heat on that, either from the party apparatus or from your peers in government or from voters?
Then the most difficult time is young people who don't know that there was once that Teddy Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln were Republicans, and there used to be a model of progressive liberal. I came from New England, you know, the Rockefellers, Jacob Javits. So these young people, I have one person who works for me now, and we went through the interview, and she said, I have a couple questions for you. And the last one was this heartfelt, how could you have been a Republican? I don't know if I could work for somebody. So it's just, you know, parties change, and it's. I think it's unfortunate what, I mean, you do have people who are unreasonable along the ideological spectrum, but Jim Jeffords said it best, Vermont, I think, senator who left the Republican Party years ago, he said, I didn't leave the Republican Party, it left me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's start edging over into one of the hot issues of our current presidential cycle. We'll get to the down and dirty political stuff a little later. We'll start with something actually policy-oriented. A question from the audience. What can be done to change our immigration policy in which we are educating foreign students at our universities and then forcing them to return to their countries of origin? Can't we give a green card with a diploma?
Well, first of all, when it comes to overall immigration policy, separate from the specifics mm-hmm. of the question, there was a bill last session. Senator McCain and Rubio were supporters. It was bipartisan. And then Speaker Boehner never brought it up in the House because his members didn't want to vote for it or against it. And it would allow a pathway for citizenship for the 11 million plus immigrants who are here who are undocumented. So I still think that's the answer on that level. And then to have more thoughtful immigration policy, which comes to H-1B visas and allowing talented people to come and get an education here and then have a pathway to citizenship should they stay here. I think you have to balance that. I just had a wonderful meeting with a UC Davis professor who spent a long time on studying this, and there's research that says that there are American workers who can do some of these. There's more than the public perception is that could do these jobs and would help people who are underemployed now in the country. So somewhere in there, and I'm not aware of it at this point, somewhere in there is a more thoughtful immigration policy when it comes to people of who you're trying to get their intellectual capacity to both go to school here and to stay here.
Now that we've uttered the phrase thoughtful immigration policy, let's turn our
attention. That's an oxymoron.
Turn our attention a moment to the presidential race. What are your thoughts on the way that immigration policy in particular is being leveraged, for want of a better word, in the early, admittedly very early stages of this presidential primary campaign?
Well, you know, Josh, one of the big problems in this country is the consultant class around political races. So we should have public financing of campaigns. We should have consultants be licensed and registered and understand who's doing the manipulation because there's this whole industry basically that wants to keep the status quo. And part of that industry, if you ask me, particularly from more conservative elements, have been fixating on scaring Americans. And some of this is based on people who don't look like the people they're targeting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I put this in some of the in the context of trying to figure out the Trump phenomenon, is that I think that's why you're seeing people respond to that, because he's going to solve the whole problem and he's going to be the great white father that gets away from all these evil people who don't look like us, and then the world will be go back to the 50s and everything will be great, which I don't think is a...
Why are people suddenly receptive to that, though, or have certain people always been?
Oh, I think there's some legitimate part of it is the world is changing and people, you know, we have always been as a species concerned about change. We all, you know, sort of like that old expression, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Everybody, we all like to think that we accept change and we're adaptable, but some of us, and some more than others, are just more resistant to it. So when not to blame people, but, you know, when you look at, like, I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, or right outside of it, and you still see the remnants of the Industrial Revolution. So for people who were used to manufacturing, and that's how people got a living and got a high school degree and had a pretty good life, when they see a lot of these things, I think there's a legitimate concern saying, well, we don't like some of these changes.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see this election cycle going?
I don't know. I just have a fervent prayer that there's one
tubes.
Outcome that doesn't happen. I don't know. You know, I was reading at New York Times somewhere, one of those papers, had a comment about how, well, the American people went from George W. Bush, who was a shoot-from-the-hip kind of guy, and mm-hmm. then they wanted somebody more thoughtful, so they went for Barack Obama, which I think was an overly simplistic view. And now maybe they want somebody like Donald Trump again. And I'd like to think that we're not that schizophrenic that, you know. Besides which, you know how hard it is to be president of the United States? I can only imagine. I mean, what a responsibility, and you're criticized regularly. And you know, one of the things I've learned about this job is, this is a shocking phenomenon for me to discover, all of these people are people with human frailties and imperfections, and humans make mistakes.
Do you think we're going to see some sort of correction in the political system, sort of the way we're seeing a correction in the stock market right now, where, you know, there's this huge inflated set of expectations and fears and stuff, and then suddenly things sort of go back and level out a little bit and get more in line with what the reality of the situation is?
I don't know. You know, I thought I was an early supporter of President Obama. I thought you don't have somebody who had a voice like he did when he started. I mean, I used to say he could be one of, I think, the fourth providential president. History may turn out to be true with Washington, Lincoln, FDR, and then him. That's just my view. Because of his ability to communicate and be genuine, I've seen less of that than when he was first candidate. Mm-hmm. I think people just crave that ability to be authentic, but we also underestimate what it takes to be that kind of communicator. So I don't know what's going to happen. I oftentimes say I think there are moments I think it's more fun to be a spectator in politics than be a participant, and this might be one of those occasions.
Says the guy who's been in politics
for
how long
now.
Yeah,
I know, I know. I've been to therapy.
I'm curious to know what you feel about sort of the flip side of that coin, you know, from Donald Trump leveraging these frustrations and fears and anger on one side. You've got a surprisingly resilient, somewhat insurgent campaign on the left from Bernie Sanders, which I think even Bernie Sanders is a little surprised by. But what do you think is going on there?
I think it's the beginning of the process. Bernie Sanders and Secretary Clinton both came to the Progressive Caucus, of which I'm a member. And, you know, they're just, in the case when Bernie came, there were only about 10 of us, so we spent some time with them. It's interesting to see a person who you're used to seeing on television in one room trying to convince you. Mm-hmm. I think the thing about Bernie is he's passionate and he's authentic, and I think people like that. Mm-hmm. I think Secretary Clinton is, but I think she's closely handled. And I just think that's a mistake. I think people want to see somebody who's genuine.
All right. Speaking of genuine, authentic, and somewhat politicized or non-politicized, you now serve on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which under its previous chairman, Darrell Issa, was seen by some as becoming heavily politicized, a sort of a partisan attack dog against the Obama administration. What are your thoughts on the committee now under Chairman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, with regards to issues like the investigation into political targeting by the IRS and some of the other probes that the committee's been undertaking?
Well, from my understanding and from observing the former chairmanship, I thought it was pretty awful. Uh-huh. I think the current chairman is better, but we still have these relapses into this gotcha mentality, which is a big part of D.C., just the gotcha mentality of trying to put people in the, particularly in toss-up districts, to have difficult votes, even though it's more theater than reality. Mm-hmm. Personally, I like being an oversight committee. You know, my work on the Bay Bridge, I enjoyed that. I'm a liberal Democrat, but I believe in government being a force for good. But I also think it should be held accountable. Mm-hmm. So when we screw up, people, there should be consequences. I believe in performance standards. Because when I was growing up, we had things like Kennedy saying we're going to go to the moon and NASA being a government agency that did that and aspired to that. So there's a balance in there. My conversations with the chairman has been I want to be supportive when we're collectively in a nonpartisan situation trying to improve the delivery of services to all Americans. And an interesting side note, I've become friends over the years with Michael Dukakis, and he is actually related by marriage to Michael Dukakis. So we talk about how we get phone calls from the former governor of Massachusetts, and it's Dukakis, and he just says, I think you should do this. And I'm like, governor?
Just at odd hours, a sudden call from Mike Dukakis.
He's fully engaged.
Fully engaged. All right. You're fully engaged. You've sponsored several pieces of legislation yourself this year. You've co-sponsored many dozens more, but let's talk about some of your bills, many of which I notice have something to do with education in one way or the other. So we've got an amendment you had sponsored requiring local education agencies to develop agreements with Head Start and other agencies to carry out better early childhood education. You've got a bill to create nationwide standards on concussion safety for school athletes. And I believe California has been a little bit more advanced on that. And your co-author with Republican Lou Barletta of a bill to modernize school lunches by requiring the Agriculture Department to make loan guarantees and grants to finance upgrades and to train personnel. Why this focus? What do you see in these elements that needs doing?
Well, one of the things you need to do, particularly when you have difficulty focusing just in your personalities, is when you're in these offices, you have to focus on areas, usually it's your committee assignments. So I was fortunate enough to replace Congressman Miller on the Education and Labor Committee, which is a bit of a coup for freshmen. So I've been trying to find ways that I could partner with the majority party to do things we both agree on. And those three, plus I have a fourth one that looks like whenever we get reauthorization, whatever form, should go into that bill. I won't be able to say it's my bill, but on the food side, as a former restaurateur, the Republicans want to roll back a lot of the traditional requirements that Congressman Miller and others put into the low and subsidized food program in schools. They've really had a remarkable effect on slowing down diabetes rates and obesity rates for kids in the
country. We're not returning to the ketchup as a vegetable.
Yes, we're not doing that again. President Reagan's vegetable. So I said, part of the problem is here that as somebody who was in the restaurant business, and when I started in San Francisco, the joke was San Francisco restaurant, the most important in the 70s, the most important piece of equipment is a can opener. Now it's completely transformed. You know, you don't have can openers. You don't even have microwaves in a lot of restaurants. It's all fresh food, and that's what we're trying to change to. So what the bill does, it sets up a grant program so school districts, including Mount Diablo, they're going to show me next week, you don't need this big freezer anymore, but you need the revenue to switch to a smaller refrigerator. Mm-hmm. You need some training standards so people have been preparing food the old way start to learn how to do it with fresh food so you don't waste as much. So I was thrilled that a Republican supported that. And another one that's important to me is requiring or allowing grants for what's called wraparound programs. So we know kids who are in distress, they do better in school if they have what's called wraparound programs. They have behavioral health people and counselors come and help them with the stress that they're going through every day in their daily life, and usually it's people in poverty. So those are two that I think will become part of a federal program that'll be funded that they wouldn't be if I hadn't brought them up, and I'm doing them with a Republican.
You made it a mission early on in this first term to visit every school district in your congressional district. I think you're still in the process of doing that because there are a lot of school districts in your district. How are you finding that these priorities and fit into what's going on in those school districts, and what else are you seeing out there as you make these visits?
Well, there's always some commonality when you go out and talk to people. One of the things about this congressional district, I'm told, is the second of 435 congressional districts as measured by education. So we've got a lot of people with graduate degrees, a lot of people with undergraduate degrees. A lot of it is the proximity of the University of California. But within that idea that it's very well-educated, areas of great poverty in Richmond, North Richmond, Bay Point, but also wealth. So the first place I went to was Monta Vista High School with some of the highest test scores in the state, and the second one was Mount Diablo in Concord. So what I'm finding is, you know, just that dichotomy we live under right now, that we've got great wealth and prosperity for many people, but we've got a lot of, we've got high poverty. But within that context, there are some common threads, and one of the biggest ones, because the federal government's role, is how we deal with special needs students with autism. Now we've seen this rising need, higher needs for the teachers to deal with kids. And the federal government had always promised to, when it was first passed in the 60s, promised to fund these programs at, I think, 40%. We're currently funding them at like 18%. So the Brentwood, superintendent of the Brentwood School District, which is in Jerry McNerney's district, told me that he could spend all the extra money coming from the revived economy just on his special needs kids. So that's been a common thing that goes across demographics in the district. And then teachers feel frustrated, I think, in all groups, because they feel like they've been vilified and blamed, and a lot of them go into teaching for the best possible reason, is they find it rewarding.
Have you started to see any results, any demonstrable product of the local control funding formula that was put into effect while you were still in Sacramento?
Yeah, so there's more money. I mean, we did a study, I think when I was in the Assembly, it might have been the Senate, it was bipartisan, and we had the Hoover Institute do it when Governor Schwarzenegger was there, and the study was very in-depth. What do we do about education in California? Mm-hmm. It came back with two things. Eliminate some of your categoricals, which we did in the local control formula, and give more discretion to local districts. And the other part was you got to spend more money. Mm-hmm. And we're doing both.
In terms of spending more money, that some of that money came from Prop 30, mm-hmm. Parts of which will be expiring on a schedule if they're not continued. What are your thoughts on I know this is a Sacramento question, mm-hmm. but you were there and you still have an interest in this. What are your thoughts on where that money is going to come from? Are we growing out of the need for those taxes?
We are, but you know, the last 48 hours has told us once again we are so dependent on capital gains tax in California, and our tax system is so that when things are going good in California, the state's doing really well.
Right.
And when things go bad, it just bears out how dependent we are on a very volatile income source. So having said that, I would put it back. If I was a governor, I'd ask the legislature to put it back in front of the voters. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we're finding consistently from reformers and people who want the status quo is you've got to function on the kid, the student, and the client in their unique environment. Long Beach School District, along with CSU down there in the community college and the business community, have done a remarkable job of that. They have difficult schools. They've just put it in their culture. We're going to take each kid. We're going to give them what he needs, and then they do better. It's not rocket science.
Right. From the audience, would you be willing to pay 5% more for all products if it meant full employment in this country to the relief of many of our social ills? Full employment means living wage jobs.
Yes.
We're talking about a sort of a paradigm shift there, I suppose, in terms of what we expect as consumers and as employees.
Well, there's this joke, you know, about people who have attempted to read Thomas Piketty's book, Capital. And the joke is that we've got to find people who have actually finished the whole book, and I'm one of them. It's still on my bedstand. I'm almost done. But I think it's general research that you have these fluctuations of capital and wages, labor. And right now we're out of sync, where capital investment is much more prominent, so that average people, their wages haven't caught up. And at some point, his argument is you've got to have a balance. I mean, Lincoln said this, if you don't have a balance between labor and capital, you don't have a democracy anymore. And I would argue Jimmy Carter's right. I mean, I wouldn't go quite as far as him. But so it to something like that, to that point, is that's how we have to get wages up. Mm-hmm. And then people have more disposable income. They go out to restaurants. We know from research that middle-income people and poor people are more inclined to spend their money in the economy. And that Bob Reich talks about this all the time. Krugman talks about this. That's a really good economic model that I would adhere to. So we need to get wages up for people.
What about your predecessor was a constant crusader for raising the minimum wage. When he finally broke through after years of resistance and won an increase in the federal minimum wage, he would immediately start working on the next one because he knew that it would take another decade or so probably to get past the resistance. Some cities have been taking it upon themselves to raise the minimum wage substantially. California just raised it, is considering raising it again. Is this an effective tool?
It is. I would argue, again, research would suggest you should do that with adjustments to the earned income tax credit. California is one of, I think, only 20 states that doesn't have a state earned income tax credit. I was co-author of a bill that would have done that, but it didn't get out because of the cost. It was about $500 million a year. The federal government has earned income tax credit. So for both of them, the minimum wage should be indexed for inflation. That's part of the problem we get into. It's like the gas tax. Mm-hmm. I have another feeling about it because I was in the restaurant business. So I know what it's like to be a point of sale retailer. And, you know, in a lot of states, the wait staff, they have a split minimum wage. And I think there's some validity to that if the tip person is making $30,000 or $40,000 a year, so they're in effect making $25, $35 an hour. Mm-hmm. I know in this state the Labor Federation and others didn't care for that. But that's my only hesitation. It's not a hesitation because I think the minimum wage should be indexed for inflation.
All right. From the audience, related to our climate change question earlier, do you personally believe the administration did the right thing in giving Shell Oil a permit to drill in the Arctic? Why or why not?
I wouldn't. I think the progress we're making in California, the renewable portfolio standard, which was 20%, now it's 33%. The governor's suggesting it be 50%, has been very successful. When I was a kid, America was a net exporter of fossil fuels. Then we were the biggest importer of it. And now, because of what we're doing on renewables, but also because of fracking, which we need to get right, and California is trying to do that right to make sure that there's no damage to the environment and getting guidelines so that it's done. If it's done, it's done with the minimalist impact to the environment and groundwater. But I don't really see the need to do what, respectfully, the administration did. We're doing really well on energy in this country, and we should continue to go the course we're going.
Let's talk about fracking, since you bring it up. You say that California needs to make sure that it gets it right in terms of groundwater protection, in terms of the surface protections that are necessary, as evidenced by the somewhat devastating effects we've seen in other states, in the Dakotas and such. A lot of people had wanted the governor last year to declare a moratorium completely on fracking until we can promulgate some very stringent regulations. He chose not to do that. He's always said that fracking is part of an economic and energy future for the state. You believe that this can be done in a safe and productive way?
I don't know. Senator Pavley passed a bill that I was co-author of that said you've got to develop these standards and gave, I think it was 3 years. Then Senator Mitchell from Los Angeles had a bill that would have set the moratorium, and the governor didn't sign that. I agreed with both those bills. I don't know why you develop strict standards and not wait, sort of the precautionary principle, until you found out if the research said you could have the standards that would properly protect the environment and groundwater. I mean, who doesn't want to make sure that petroleum products don't seep into the people's groundwater? So I would respectfully have disagreed. I did disagree with the governor's position. And I don't think it's inevitable that we do fracking in California. I think it's something we should look at and really investigate intensely. But I think we should put our focus on renewables in California, which we have.
All right. I know we're ping-ponging around here, but we have a rare request for audience participation, which I will entertain in a limited way, which will involve some squinting past the lights here. An audience member requests that we ask who is in favor or not in favor of agreeing to the nuclear deal with Iran. So if we could start a show of hands based on what you, the audience, know. Sorry, radio audience, you'll have to imagine this. From what you know of this deal, do you believe that Congress should approve this deal? Raise your hand. That is, okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Those opposed? All right. There are a number of opposed, but the audience is relatively overwhelmingly in favor of supporting this deal. Is that what you've been seeing at your town halls?
The two we've had at Pleasant Hill, we did the similar thing, and it was probably not quite as demonstrative. Mm-hmm. It was about 60-40. At Rossmore, I don't believe we actually went through the drill. But that's the general sentiment, I feel, is
in favor.
I think they're... You know, that's such a difficult place in the world. The reason why I'd vote for it today is because clearly what we've worked, the way we've done things before, heretofore, particularly the invasion of Iraq, which I was very much against, has not worked. Mm-hmm. So we've got to take a different approach. But that the difficulty in making sure the Iranian government complies with the agreement and what happens with the cash, how much they can give to terrorist groups that then threatens Americans and Israelis is one of my hesitations.
Gotcha. At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Josh Richmond, political reporter for the Bay Area News Group and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest tonight is California's 11th District Representative, Congressman Mark DeSaunier. Let's stay on the Middle East for just a second. Obviously, the Shia regime in Iran would be more aligned with Hezbollah and groups like that, not with ISIS, which is the current big security worry that a lot of people have in the Middle East. What are your thoughts on the ISIS situation and the level of involvement that's appropriate for the United States?
Well, when we were on the Golan Heights, it was a beautiful day when I was over there, and this Israeli one-star general was standing with a group of us, and he pointed out to the horizon, well, it wasn't the horizon, near to us in Syria, and he said, "You see that smoke out there?" And he said, "Sure." He said, "That's Hezbollah and ISIL fighting each other and killing each other." And it was pretty, you know, relatively close, so it was sort of a demonstrative. The limited information I know, I think, first of all, soft power is as much as you can do, that our ideals, when we properly apply them for a secular democracy and a vibrant economy, are not transferable completely in different parts of the world or as easily as we think, and we've learned that. But I think the use of power in areas like that, you've got to be really, when we've learned this, be very careful about. So I think the president is trying to strike that balance, but it's really difficult when you have groups like this who are not open to any kind of reasonable dialogue. They're true believers in their worldview.
All right. A question from the audience. Your predecessor, Congressman Miller, seems to keep coming up in conversation.
I know. I should have brought his shoes.
He looms large.
I should just get a pair of his shoes and take them as a shtick.
That would be pretty funny, actually.
And just put them down and say, "I can't get into these things." I told people once, I said, "Those aren't shoes. They're boats. In a flood, they'll save us all."
Well, this is good, because this question sort of directs it toward your future. And the question is, Congressman Miller had said that the passage of the Affordable Care Act was among his major career achievements. He counted it among the most important moments that he had during his 40 years in Congress, and a great way to sort of wrap up that tenure. What do you think your Affordable Care Act might be looking forward? What piece of legislation, what change do you hope to be a part of during your time in the House?
That's a great question. You know, I'm 63 years old. I've been doing this a while. So as you get older, I see some white hairs out in the audience. You start thinking about, you know, all of us, what our lives did and what you reflect back on. And I'm at a point where I'm now part of an institution where I'm considered relatively young compared to the overall composition. What I would really like to be part of is changing the institution to make it work more overall in a global standard. And that will be a struggle. I think on the macro level, if Americans don't have faith and trust in their government agencies and the people they elect, and we'll always be suspect. There's a wonderful book by Gary Wills called A Necessary Evil, and he talks about the history of how Americans don't trust governmental institutions because of how we were founded and the people in power, which has worked well for this country. I would argue it's not working right now. So if I was part of, through the things I'm doing on oversight or the things I'm partnering and trying to get both parties to start focus on the greater good, we recently had a dinner in the Library of Congress where David McCullough came to talk, and I love David McCullough, and a member of Congress who's talking about his book, The Wright Brothers and Get Off and other things. And a member asked a question of Mr. McCullough. He said, "Mr. McCullough, you've got members of Congress here. We're sitting in the Library of Congress. What would you suggest to Congress? What should we do, members?" And he looked out, his cheek was out, and he had that pause, and he said, "What I would recommend is courage." And then he paused, and he said, "Members should be willing to vote in a way that might end up in them not getting reelected, but when they know it's in the greater good of the country." So there was a period where we had more of that for reasons that I can't comprehend. So on a macro level, that. On a more specific level, I don't think you can have a democracy without a robust public education system. Franklin and Jefferson expounded that at the founding of this country, that literally you can't have democracy if people don't get a good public education and be able to problem solve and understand when people are lying to them or misleading them. Mm. On a specific level, that would be my ACA.
All right. In terms of the intestinal fortitude you spoke of a moment ago about casting the votes that are not necessarily in line with your own personal political interests, that's been in short supply. And do you feel here in California, given the advent of our top two primary system, which has opened the door to more intra-party challenges, do you feel that is liberating in some way or makes no difference to the way that you look at your electorate, your votes, your aims, your goals? Has it changed the way that you think you have to run campaigns?
I think it's to be determined. I think the sad part is both sides, more conservative elements who have vested interest in California and more liberal ones, are figuring out how to sort of game the system. Mm-hmm. Again, I think when you look at demographics, like in this district, the voter turnout's high because people are highly educated. When you look at poorer districts, they don't vote as well, and they often vote against their own best interest. So, again, I think if you have a robust public education system, and you need to have public financing as much as you can with independent expenditures, and with the Supreme Court now saying that's off limits, I think transparency, because of the internet, there's lots of good nonprofits now, and hopefully the media will connect campaign donations more with quid pro quo type of activity. Mm-hmm. But I also am not naive. I mean, I've been through this. I have taken tough votes, and then I have tried to dodge tough votes, particularly early in my career. Mm-hmm. It's liberating getting older and, you know.
What were some of the tough votes you tried to dodge earlier in your career?
That's a good question.
You knew I had a seize on that.
Look at his eyelid.
This got interesting.
Look at this. Well, pension reform. You know, when I was going through that, when we voted for it, the county, four of us voted for it, and we were being told by actuaries, some of them were saying you can afford this, others weren't. And I've been close to labor for years, and I took a leap of faith, and it turned out we couldn't afford it, so we had to go back and fix it. I think if I were to do that now in my career, I would have been more at the table going, I'm not ready to do this. We need something less than what we're about to prove.
On the topic of pension reform, do you find that the situation is accurately portrayed? Is it overblown? Do you have any thoughts on the reform efforts for example, the measure that San Jose Mayor Chuck Reed had championed that he's now trying to export to the state level in partnership with Carl DeMeo. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't support that initiative. I think we've made good progress. I think there's more to be made. I think there's another whole discussion in this country about, particularly with the baby boomers, people should be able to, and with what's happened with the market and the 401ks, that's not a real sustainable model either. But on a larger level, I think we as a culture have to accept the fact that we have a responsibility, particularly when people are living older, to develop a system that's sustainable so people can retire at a reasonable age, retire with some level of financial security, and be able to continue to live their lives fully. That people are living to their 90s now is not uncommon. But you don't live that way if you don't have enough financial resources. You can, but the probability isn't as high if you have the resources to get the kind of support you need.
There's constant talk from the other side of the aisle when it comes to retiring with dignity and security of reforming government entitlement programs, as some people refer to them, and some people don't particularly like that label. But Social Security, Medicare, do you believe that these are adequately funded? Do you believe that they need to be reformed in some way? Do any adjustments need to be made in terms of retirement age or eligibility?
No, I think we should have a sustainable revenue source in this country for both of those things, to be consistent with the comments I just made. I mean, I was co-author in the legislature for single-payer health care reform. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, California, because the ACA precluded states from doing that until the ACA got developed in 2017, my memory is that we'll go through that again. So you look at the rest of the industrialized world, most of the countries we compete with, they have a more robust social safety net, as generally, than we do. And the problem with entitlements, I think, it's a revenue. We have to, and there's ways we can sustain that, including, the old comment about the bank robber, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. I'd go back to a more progressive tax system where people in the top percent would pay more. Mm-hmm. And that corporations, we would tighten the offshoring issues. There's enough corporate loopholes that would focus on the disparity in this country. And I'm not against people doing well and succeeding, but it's sort of obscene in my view right at this point in terms of the extreme wealth and the tax incentives for people keeping that money in the top 0.5%.
The income inequality issue, as we said earlier, this is something that Robert Reich talks mm-hmm. about a lot. Obviously, we're hearing a lot of it from Bernie Sanders right now. It seemed to sort of catch fire during the years of the Occupy movement. It really brought it into the public eye in a way. We started talking about the 1% in a way that we hadn't before. But it almost seems like that tide receded a little bit. From the days when there were encampments springing up in a lot of our cities. How do you sustain that dialogue about income inequality? How do we get to a point where it's meaningfully addressed in a way that's palatable to most Americans?
Well, this is the basic argument in this country is we are a merit-based country who believes in individual merit with a support system. But then we believe also that we are a country of communities and that we have shared values. And that's just the history of, I think, this country and species. So we're out of balance right now. Mm-hmm. We're too focused on rugged individualism that doesn't allow for opportunity. We don't have, as Bob Reich writes about in his research, and Joseph Stiglitz writes about this, Krugman writes about this in his research, if you don't have opportunity in the United States, you don't have the United States. You have to have the ability to people to get an education, apply themselves to work hard, and to have upward mobility. And then they have to have the resources to be able to retire and raise their kids and give them a good education. And then that's America. That's the American dream. Right now we have too few opportunities for Americans to move up within one generation, much less within a generation or a half or two, if you're not already there. My kids fortunately benefit from what I've done in my life, but not all kids have that opportunity. Almost 25% of Californians are now in poverty. That's not acceptable.
And in a directly related question, both in terms of social movements and in terms of poverty and opportunity. Your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think it's really important. If anybody's read the book, The New Jim Crow, by a Stanford researcher, Michelle, I'm spacing her last name. I read that a few years ago. I read it, and I thought, well, I'm liberal, I'm progressive. I know these statistics when it comes to poverty and incarceration are accurate. And I put it aside and started reading something else. And I don't remember doing this. It disturbed me so much that I went back and read it again because I was thinking about myself and my role in this is we still have a very large race problem in this country. And again, we're not fully closer to a more perfect union if we don't deal with these issues. I mean, the fact that I used to have the budget subcommittee in the Senate that had corrections in it. I'd go out to these prisons, and, you know, the statistics are pretty, I don't remember them all, but the majority of people in prisons in the state of California are of color. They're men of color. And so we need to go back and look at that root cause, and it is education and opportunity again, and some racism.
As pertains to the public safety aspects of that, your thoughts on the recent demonstrations over police shootings and the tactics that Black Lives Matter activists have used in trying to call attention to the movement during this presidential campaign?
Yeah, on the tactics, I think sometimes those don't work. When the cause becomes Albert Camus' great book many of us had to read when we were in college about when you become a rebel, you become self-defeating. Mm-hmm. I think the demonstrations on Wall Street when we were talking about disparity, I think when average people start seeing the kind of actions that were in Oakland that were disruptive, they lost sympathy from average people. I think Black Lives Matter has to be careful about that as well. But at the same time, they need to be passionate and care about it and be willing to do what Frederick Douglass once said. He said, agitate, agitate, agitate. So mm-hmm. somewhere in there is the proper way. But we as a culture definitely have to realize it. And then when it comes to public safety, cultural competence and training police departments, Richmond is a perfect example. You've got a police chief over there in management who understands these things, and you see the difference in the relationship between the community and the providers of public safety. They cooperate. The crime rates have gone down demonstratively. Everybody, the New York Times does a story on it. People are coming out to research it. It's not rocket science. It's about people with good management skills being empathetic and doing best practices and then constantly retraining their officers to make sure you've got a foul policy, but you don't take shortcuts.
I think it's worth noting that Chief Magnus, uh-huh. I believe, in Richmond, actually took some flack from the law enforcement community last year by showing up at a rally holding a Black Lives Matter sign.
I'm a big fan of Chief Magnus. He's sensational. We're lucky to have him here.
All right. One last question related to that. There's a current of thought that white men, like you and I, are not really qualified to talk about or judge the tactics of a Black Lives Matter movement. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I agree. We can't have the same worldview as African Americans who've been subject to it. I acknowledge that. But to the degree I'm on this planet and I'm a policymaker and we're part of the solution, you try to be empathetic, but you also express yourself. And I just did.
All right. Very good. Is this a question that comes up in your town hall meetings? I'm curious about the Black Lives Matter.
No, they haven't. We have one in El Cerrito tomorrow, maybe more a function of where I've had them mm-hmm. most recently since these incidents started. I did, we had a wonderful meeting in Pittsburgh where the mayor, who's African-American law enforcement, after Ferguson happened, I told him, I said, why don't we organize some of the ministers and the police chief, and we did, and it was a wonderful meeting just to talk about how do we create better communication locally. So those are the things you need to do.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question, so I will throw to the audience for this one. You've spent decades serving Contra Costa County. It's still your freshman year in Congress, but should we expect to see you continue climbing the political ladder? Any aspirations beyond the House?
I describe myself in Washington, D.C. as Contra Costa's Forrest Gump. I don't. I've just had these weird things happen where, you know, doors have opened. I feel, you know, truthfully, just amazingly graced to be able to do these jobs. People complain about these jobs, and it's like any job. Nobody likes to be told you're, you know, an idiot or incompetent or a crook or all of the above. But they're so rewarding, you know. As Nancy Pelosi told a group of us when the 18 Democrats in the freshman class got elected, you're one of 12,818 people who have ever served in the U.S. Congress. For somebody who believes that, as Jefferson said, America is the last best hope for humanity, to be in that position and to represent this community, you know, doesn't get better than that. So I think I've Peter principled out, but I've thought that before.
I can't think of a better closing line than that. Our thanks to Congressman Mark DeSaunier, representing California's 11th District, for joining us here tonight. We also thank our audiences here on the radio and online. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.